KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
What we intend to do is to have a very well-regulated system where we can track the marijuana from the grower to the distributor to the retailer to make sure that there's as little leakage as humanly possible outside of that growth chain.
But we are going to insist on changes at Hanford. We are going to insist on a program that will remove the radioactive material from the leaking tanks and find a solution as quickly as humanly possible.
We know what works. STEM education, better teacher evaluations, early childhood education, mechanisms that can improve the graduation rate, all of which I built into my budget priorities.
That's Governor Jay Inslee talking about his priorities around pot, around Hanford, around education. We're going to ask him about his priorities there as well and ask him for his reaction to what has happened in Boston, which was where we'll start. More than 500 Washington State residents were registered to run in the Boston Marathon. 78-year-old Bill Ifrig, a retired Mason carpenter. He's well known around the region. He's run 45 marathons, reportedly, and this was his third Boston Marathon. He's listed as one of the nation's top master long-distance runners for his age category. He finished fourth among men ages 75 to 79, according to the Boston Marathon website. And he did finish, even though he was just 15 to 20 feet from the finish line when the first blast went off.
Oh, it was. Yeah, a lot of people are hurt badly, you know. Nothing happened to me. I was very fortunate, but there's a lot of people in the hospital yet that more of them might die, you know.
Yeah, it's tragic. But we see this picture of you that was taken. You were knocked down. You felt the force of the blast. Is that right?
Yeah, I had headed towards the finish line. I only had maybe 20 feet to go. And, of course, I'm concentrating on getting this done with. I've been out here, you know, pretty near 4 hours. And all of a sudden, a bomb went off next to me. Oh, my God, it was so loud. I just took my hearing away. It was so loud. And I had no idea what it was. And at the same time, kind of like the shock waves hit my body and caused my legs to just buckle up underneath me, and I felt myself going down to the road and crashed on the road there and laid there a few minutes and started getting my senses back again. And in the meantime, I'm wondering, hey, maybe this is the end. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's happened to me. But anyway, I started coming back to life there and started moving around a little bit, and everything seemed to be working all right. So, and at that time, guys were coming over and asked me if I was okay. And so finally, they helped me up, and we continued on. And I went up and crossed the finish line because I was so close to it that I crossed the finish line to complete the race. And they took me over and checked me out a little bit with one of the assistants there at the finish line. And he said, well, I'll get a wheelchair and get you back to where you want to go. And in the meantime, before they got over there, I said, hey, I think I'm all right, really, no problems. I'll be able to walk up. We were only six blocks away. We were staying at the Park Plaza. And so I just started hoofing it up there. And by then, it was getting to be regular chaos around the whole area because all the emergency vehicles and services were coming in there, and other runners weren't able to even continue on down towards the finish line. They shut them off, and so a lot of this stuff I didn't even know what was going on until after hearing it on the news, but I immediately thought of a bomb, though, because it was so loud. And it just knocked me right down.
Who was with you at the marathon? Was somebody with you watching you finish?
My wife was here at the hotel, and she heard the blast, but she didn't know what was going on, of course. And finish area is just loaded with people. They got a regular grandstand section there for people watching the finishers. And so there was a lot of people there, and nobody I knew that. There were some other fellows from my hometown that were there at the race, but they had finished earlier and they went up to their rooms. So they didn't know anything about it until I talked to them later in the day.
It's quite remarkable that you were knocked down by such a powerful blast. When you were on the ground, what did you see around you?
Well, I looked over and I could see the smoke rolling out, and I seen the debris from this terrible explosion. It was like a bunch of heavy dust and stuff that had come loose from someplace, and I didn't know what that was all about, but I thought it had something to do with that bomb blast. And I didn't hear anybody screaming or anything like that, but before I got away from the accident scene there, they were bringing those people out, and some of them were coming out in wheelchairs, and they were bleeding badly, and it was really a mess. And later found that there were a lot of injuries.
Did you hear, how many bomb blasts did you hear?
I heard two. There was, I think about, they said 12 seconds or so in between them, or 12, maybe it was 12 minutes.
No, 12 seconds. 12 seconds.
12 seconds. Okay. There was definitely two. The first one was the loudest, and then the second one was, you could hear it too, but not as loud, near as loud.
Was it the first one that knocked you down?
Yes.
And then as you're on the ground, you heard the second one?
Yeah, well, I don't know just where I was at. In the process of trying to get up, I think something like that. And probably my hearing wasn't as good by then anyway. Maybe that's why it didn't seem very loud. But
wow.
Yeah.
Quite something. How long do you think you were on the ground before you got up?
Well, I don't know. It didn't take me very long. I laid there and for a little while, and three policemen come over. Maybe you've seen some of the pictures. They were standing there talking to me, asking how I was doing and everything. And I said, well, I think I'm doing okay, and I haven't found any injuries or anything. I wasn't bleeding. I did scrape my knee up a little bit, but just a minor injury. And so then shortly after that, the guy that was taking care of the finish line there came over and asked if he could help me. And I said, yeah, well, give me a hand. And we hobbled on over to the finish line. I crossed the finish line and then eventually got out of there. And a lot of the other runners that were on the road at the same time I was, they continued on so they could get out of there, you know, finish the race and move on.
It was important for you to finish.
Well, oh, yeah, after you spent the whole day out there, you know, 26 miles, and then thing on my mind for the whole day was to finish. So I naturally wanted to do that, and I didn't have anything that was bothering me that. No reason why I shouldn't. So.
You're 78 years old, sir. Are you going to run another marathon?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see. See how it goes.
Bill Ifrig is from Lake Stevens, Washington. The force of one of the blasts in the Boston Marathon, the first one, threw him to the ground. Yet he finished the race. His wife was waiting for him at his nearby hotel room. You can see his photo at KOW.org. Herald.com has an article, so does Seattle Times. You know, these eyewitness accounts are important for us to get on the air, for us all to hear. If you know somebody who was in Boston who can give us an eyewitness account, we'd appreciate you writing us with their contact information. Weekday at KOW.org. We'll try to get them on the air later in the show. So if you know somebody who was an eyewitness, or if you were an eyewitness, you're listening. Weekday at KOW.org. Send us an email. We'll try to get them on the show. We'll hear what they experienced during the bombing. Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington State. He joins us to talk about a number of things. But Governor, thank you for talking to us.
Good morning.
Good morning. You heard that conversation with Bill Ifrig. I imagine you've been getting all sorts of information and briefings. Anything you want to tell us about what your reaction is to this bombing, but also about what you're hearing in terms of security and the like for Washington State?
Well, there are no evidence of increased threats or concerns above and beyond background for the state of Washington, so there hasn't been any particular response to this other than our continued caution as appropriate. And as far as the feelings I have about it, I'm sure they're the same as everyone's, of mourning the losses of people who are going to such a wonderful event and have these losses. But it's coupled with admiration for a Washingtonian, Mr. Ifrig, who I think is a perfect metaphor for the country. His inspirational leadership is, you know, we take these blows and get back up and finish the race. That's a pretty good inspirational message for the country, and we might have to get the IFRIG award to award him for the state of Washington. It really is an inspirational story for the country.
I bet he'd like that. I bet he'd like that.
He deserves it.
All right, Governor. I appreciate that, and we'll be back to this story. Let's talk about some of the issues that you're facing in the legislature to start with. Where do we stand today, and your thoughts about what the legislature has done on a couple of controversial issues to start with? The Reproductive Parity Act, looks like the Senate is not going to put that through. What's your reaction?
Well, we're not done on that issue. I feel very strongly that our state ought to continue maintaining the respect for a woman's privacy to make their own individual decisions about their reproductive status. And for that reason, it ought to be the law of the state of Washington, and I believe ultimately will be the law in the state of Washington, that no insurance company can deny a woman's right of choice, that no insurance company can deny coverage for a woman's right, whatever decision they make for their reproductive future. So to date, this bill has been blocked to guarantee every woman the right to be able to obtain insurance for this coverage and a protection to prevent the insurance companies from denying that constitutional right to a woman. That's been blocked so far for a vote in the Senate. I will be working very strongly and diligently to make sure that it gets a vote in the state Senate. And the reason is that it appears to me at the moment, at least, that there are the votes to pass this in the Senate. And the reason is that people, even a few Republicans, are going to stand up and protect a woman's right of reproductive freedom in this state. So we're going to continue this effort. I think it's important for our state.
What's your leverage?
Well, the most important leverage is the will of the people. We're in a pro-choice state. We were the first state in the union to vote in American history to respect a woman's right of choice. The will of the people is the ultimate leverage here. We've got to follow the will of the people, and people want this protection for our sisters and our nieces and our wives, so that no insurance company can deny them what legally and constitutionally should be their private right of decision for themselves. Now, as a governor, I do have the ability to bring people to the table in a lot of different ways, and I'll be doing that. We need a vote on this bill before the end of our session. The legislature owes this to the people of the state of Washington to vote on this subject.
So you'll be sitting down with who to try to make this go through, get this through?
Well, I'll be sitting down, and I'll be standing up, too, because I want to stand up for a woman's right of privacy rights here, and I'll be talking to the Senate leadership to make sure that this gets a vote and do everything humanly possible I can. And again, this is not for some, you know, just to be vocal on this subject. I think this bill does have the votes and will have the votes to pass the Senate. And to me, it would be extremely lamentable if somehow politics got in the way of the will of not only the people, but the will of the senators to actually vote on this. The women of the state of Washington deserve that right.
Part of the concern is that when we have a federal health insurance plan in place, that women are covered. Are you worried that if this doesn't get through, that could be lacking?
Well, certainly right now, insurance companies, you never know what particular profit motive may drive them, would have the legal ability to deny a woman's right of choice. And this is a constitutional right. I mean, this is not a small matter. A woman today has the right with her own conscience and her own beliefs to make a decision. It is protected by the United States Constitution. And what the United States Constitution allows and protects for a woman's right of privacy, I do not believe any insurance company ought to be able to take away. And so this is an important thing for the women of our state, and it's entirely consistent with how we have voted and how we have operated as a state now for several decades. So as I've said, legislators need to be held to account, step up and have a vote on this bill, and I will be urging them and exercising the appropriate measures to do everything I can to get a vote.
All right. We'll ask you more about what the cudgel is in just a minute. Governor Jay Inslee is our guest. More questions for the governor ahead on Weekday.
So
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture. Proud supporters of the National Parks Conservation Association. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
45 degrees in Seattle with some clouds, but expecting the day to turn out mostly sunny with a high of 58. Bellingham reporting 46 degrees under a clear sky, Olympia 36 and foggy, and in Vancouver, Washington, it's 40 degrees and misty.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, a member-owned, not-for-profit credit union that offers financial services to its members and supports the communities where they live. BECU has more than 800,000 members and is growing. Information about services online at BECU.org.
It's 9:20. We'll get a recommendation for a hike to match the week's weather in about 30 minutes.
Governor Jay Inslee is governor of Washington State. He joins us through the magic of telephony from Olympia. Governor, another issue that doesn't seem to be making it through the state legislature is what we were calling the Washington version of the DREAM Act. That also doesn't seem to be getting a vote. What's your cudgel there? Do you want to see it come to a vote here in this session?
Well, I would prefer to use logic and the will of the voters as opposed to cudgels, and I do want to see this have a vote. Again, this is something I think has a very good chance of success in the state Senate if, in fact, there is a vote. And the reason is that we understand that we've educated these children. They are bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, eager young people, and we've now put them through high school, and then just to drop them off the cliff, educational cliff right then, and then not allow them to participate in higher education when we got some bright minds that might want to go out and start a business or do some good work, it just doesn't make sense. So there is a refrain here that there are some things that I believe have the votes to pass, do represent the will of the voters, are good for our economic development, that are not being given a vote in the Senate. And I will, again, be using all of the powers that are available to me, starting with persuasion and moving up from there to get votes on these measures. We have the same situation, in a sense, on some of the gun safety issues that I think have a chance to pass the legislature this year. Look, these are hard measures. I understand sometimes people are skittish for legislators, but they need to stand up to the line and fish or cut bait and take votes on these measures. I think the Washington voter deserves that. And if we have these votes, I think we're going to make substantial progress. You know, I'll tell you the moment for me where this came into clear focus on the DREAM Act. I was meeting with some students, and I met a young man who goes to the Lincoln Center in Tacoma. And he was a very impressive young fellow. He had some, as I recall, had some dreams of being a business person. And we were talking about graduation rates, about how we improve our really sort of scandalous dropout rates that are as much as 50% in some of our ethnic communities in our state. And his statement was, look, I want to do well. I have a future I'd like to have, but why should I stay in high school if it means I can't afford to go to college? You need to give me a vision for my own future to keep me interested in high school itself. And a little light went off in my mind that this is not just a college issue, it's a high school issue of how we keep people inspired to stay involved in algebra and chemistry in their junior and senior years to make sure they see a future for themselves. So I'm hopeful that we can make progress on this. I hope it's on a bipartisan basis. The future of kids ought not to be a partisan issue.
Some of the Republicans looking at this issue have argued in their budget proposal that they've increased need grants in their budget, and that may take care of some of the pressure that's coming from the DREAM Act. Do you disagree with that?
Well, no, it doesn't solve the problem because there's eligibility issues that this addresses. So, no, that does not solve the problem. And if people are concerned about access to all kids in the state, as we all should, then I invite my Republican colleagues to join me in actually creating a financial base to fund our schools. And I have created a proposal to do that, to put $1.2 billion into our schools, including need grants, to in fact allow people to really enjoy their future educationally in our state. And I hope we're successful in that.
You know, the DREAM Act, which was to get more more funding, more grants to undocumented students, and the Reproductive Parity Act, which would require health plans to cover abortion if they cover other maternity services, have said to be the most important bills for Democrats this year, or among the most important bills. And it was they were sponsored by some moderate Republicans who helped take control of the Senate. How do you feel those moderate Republicans have acted in their leadership positions?
Well, you know, it's not hugely productive for governors or legislators to be sort of issuing scorecards for each other. I'm interested in a result for real people and their real lives as opposed to sort of political theater. So I'm not going to give you just an up or down answer to that particular question. I will say this. I think that any legislative body is most successful when it allows people to recognize ways to help real people in their real lives. And I think giving women a real protection of a privacy right so an insurance company cannot abuse them by denying them a constitutionally protected right, that's the right thing for any legislative leader to do of either party. I think giving students the right to be able to have a college education, these are kids, a lot of them who've been here for their entire lives, they don't even remember different countries and where they've lived. That's the right thing not only for them, but for economic development. I think it's the right thing to allow votes on these issues of gun safety. The fact that we have not closed the gun show loophole. You know, we had a violent incident in Boston yesterday, but we lost three people, and we all are heartsick about that today. But we lost a lot of other people to gun violence yesterday that are not in the headlines across the country. I don't know what the number is, but it's probably a multiple of three. And we have not closed the gun show loophole yet. That's a measure that we need our leaders to allow a vote on. And so I think all three of those measures, because they represent broad majorities in our state, have a very, very good chance of passing. And I am going to try to inspire leaders to bring this to a vote. That hasn't happened yet. Some of the leaders who have even signed off on these bills won't bring them to a vote. Let's vote. Let's keep our state moving forward.
You know, regarding that gun show loophole, we have read about a lot of lobbying by gun advocates to water down or not bring these issues to a vote. Are you having conversations with those lobbyists and trying to persuade them?
No, I mean, I haven't really been talking to lobbyists about this subject. This is something that you don't need sort of a lobbyist to explain this issue to anyone. This is a really clear issue. It makes no sense in this day and age to be allowing the sale of guns to felons. That just makes no sense. That's why there's 80 or 90% acceptance and approval of the proposition that we ought not to have gun shows that are selling to felons without checking. It makes no sense to have a legal regime to protect Washingtonians from the sale of guns to felons at places other than gun shows. That's the biggest loophole you can drive a machine gun through. Now, it's not machine guns we're talking about. I realize that, so it's a bad metaphor. But the point is that this does not pass the common sense test to not close this particular loophole. And we see the violence continue in our society. I'm calling on the legislators to have a vote on this subject.
Well, common sense is, it's easy to say something has common sense, but it seems like you're having, not just you, but the supporters having a hard time convincing the other side that they're acting out of common sense. So I guess I just have to ask you one more time. You don't want to be seen as flailing. You guys want to get this stuff passed. What's your leverage? Is it the budget? Is it some funding? Because common sense doesn't seem to be bringing these things to a vote.
Well, let me address it this way. I don't think it's productive to make threats or at this point in the session. The way I intend to do business is a little bit, you know, like Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly but carry a big stick. People know the governor has particular abilities to influence the consequences of any legislation. People need to be aware that I am very, very serious about having a vote on these measures that express the vast majority of Washingtonians, that I consider it irresponsible not to have votes on these measures, and I will be acting accordingly. So people need to know how much I am committed to these measures, and I am.
Governor, today you're going to discuss new DUI legislation, and driving under influence legislation. And in a good part, this is about ratcheting up on those people who are arrested and have to have interlocking ignition systems in their car before they can get those cars out from impound. How much stronger do you think this legislation is than what's in place now?
Well, this is a big step forward that we will be proposing this afternoon, and it's long, long overdue. This is something I've been felt very strongly about for a long time. I started my legal career prosecuting drunk drivers, and for a long time I've believed that we have undervalued the severity of this crime. This is a crime that, you know, it's not a property crime. This is life itself. You know, we had our three loss in the Boston tragedy yesterday, but we lose 27 people every single day to drunk driving in this country, and that'll happen again today and the day after if we don't take action. So we are proposing a suite of measures today that I think will be a good step forward in this regard. It's going to deal not only with trigger locks, but it's going to deal with a fundamental problem, which is that we have way too many people who are repeat offenders, and we are not getting to the root of the problem, which is their alcohol abuse. And we will be proposing some measures today to get to that root of that problem, to not allow repeat offenders to continue to drive while they have a chronic pattern of alcohol abuse. And I don't want to get ahead of myself too much. We'll be having a press conference on this afternoon. But it is not acceptable in our state that you can have 3, 4, 5 drunk driving offenses or impaired driving offenses and not have a forceful, effective, measurable, objectively provable way of proving you're not drinking and have access to a car. And we're going to make sure we get to that. And we'll be talking about that suite of things today. It's not just trigger locks. We got to do a lot more than that.
Yeah, nice. But there you go.
Thank you.
Interlocks.
Thanks a lot.
Well, all right.
Interlock, thank you.
Without getting ahead of yourself, let me just ask that. The complaint has been that in the state that the ignition devices, that they weren't enforced well, and that somebody could get around them or say they were going to do it and not do it. Does this proposal put the onus on the owner of the vehicle to have those operating and in place and verifiable often?
We will take some measures to make it more effective on the ignition interlock devices. But people have to realize there are ways around even interlock devices, one of which is to borrow someone else's car or rent a car or buy another car. Now, we cannot, it's not feasible if someone is not in custody to have an officer accompany a repeat drunk driver 24 hours a day to make sure they can't get access to any car. What we've got to do is insist that those repeat offenders stop drinking alcohol. And we have to be insistent in that regard. And other states have measures that we will be talking about this afternoon to strike at the heart of that problem. And we've had people, again, 3, 4, 5 offenses and then have the tragedies that we've had in the last couple weeks in Western Washington. And so we're going to go right to that heart of the problem. We will do things to have improved interlocks, but people got to understand that's not enough. We have to be much more aggressive on both a hammer on these irresponsible drivers and a method to have them stop drinking. And that's ultimately what we have to do to end these repeat offenders. Now, we also have to have, in my view, a more aggressive stance for the non-repeat offenders. You know, you can kill someone on your first offense pretty easily in a drunk driving situation. So this is a message we've got to continue to emphasize with increased resources to our law enforcement personnel of emphasis patrols and prosecutors who actually have the resources to prosecute these crimes so they don't get pled down to negligent driving and just to avoid things on people's records. So this is a resource issue, and we're going to address both of those this afternoon.
Did you think when you were prosecuting drunk drivers all those years ago that you'd still be dealing with what appears to be too many holes in Washington state's laws?
We actually have had, we don't want to have false pleasure at the success we have had because of the diligence of the state patrol and police officers and the public and churches and everyone else in our community. We have reduced to some significance the rate of people who are being killed by drunk driving. But it's still in the hundreds. And I talked to one of my friends, former mayor of Burien, you know, during the campaign. I remember I got a call from him. I was driving up in Snohomish campaigning, and he told me he'd just lost his daughter, who was just standing by the side of the road or on a sidewalk, and she's just this wonderful 20-year-old, bright person, and was run over by a drunk driver. Just, she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the pain in my friend's voice at this immeasurable loss because of someone's gross irresponsibility, that was piercing. And that's something I carry very deeply with him, with me. And that's why, frankly, when I saw the first proposals that were floating here, I didn't think they were adequate. I thought we needed a more aggressive standpoint. And I thought if a governor weighed in, we could get a more aggressive approach. And I'm pretty confident we are going to get a more aggressive approach to this crime. And we'll be talking about the specifics of that this afternoon.
Governor, let me ask you about a story that our colleague Austin Jenkins had regarding the discovery that the Washington State Department of Licensing has an office that issued fake driver's licenses to CIA agents who were going undercover. Governor Gregoire said she never knew about the program. You apparently were briefed on it after it was revealed to the reporters. As a congressman from Washington in Washington, D.C., had you ever heard of this program?
You know, this is a little bit of a hard thing to talk about because we have some restrictions on security issues, one of which is that any time you talk about secure issues involving national security, you're very restricted what you can or cannot talk about. So it's difficult for us in public life to address questions about this. So I'm going to be a little bit limited what I can tell you. I'll just tell you this. I was aware in a general sense that at times local governments do provide information to national security agencies, including the CIA. I was not aware of specific activities in the state of Washington. Still at this moment, we are on this kind of cone of silence, if you use a terrible expression, about our ability to talk about some of these things. What I can tell you at the moment is that I haven't been aware of abusive conduct that I think would cause concern to Washingtonians regarding a particular relationship of our state agencies with security agencies federally. I'm unaware of anything that gives me concern. I can tell you that much. So any follow-up questions, I'll try to give you as much as I can.
Well, let me just ask it this. Is it, do you think, now that you're governor, is it appropriate to cooperate with the CIA, especially in light of the fact that this program is supposed to be for law enforcement only and the CIA is not officially a law enforcement agency?
Well, the distinction between law enforcement and security, it can be kind of gray at some point. I think the tragedy in Boston certainly articulates why it's important for us to have a vigorous anti-terrorism effort. Whether anti-terrorism is considered law enforcement or a version of law enforcement blending into security, it's hard to sort of, with a fine scalpel, segregate those. I will just tell you that from what I have information is going on, and let's just say hypothetically, let's take a hypothetical. How about that? This is the best way around this problem. Hypothetically, if the state of Massachusetts would provide identification in a review of terrorism activities to agents who are duly certified, who are operating under the mandates of the federal government and not outside of them, who are compliant with state law, I do not have a problem with that. If we're going to have a robust approach to these real threats, to me, that does not cause me undue concern. Now, there are lots of issues about maintaining the appropriate level of scrutiny on federal security issues, and we saw some abuses in the 70s that led to some restrictions on those security activities domestically, and those maintain in place. We do have some pretty significant restrictions on the ability to do security gathering by these agencies domestically. They remain in place, and nothing the state is going to do is going to reduce those.
Yeah, well, you have been one of those people who worked on those issues back in Washington, D.C. I was wondering, given that you're a governor now, how does this notion, the fact that this program exists, the fact that governors didn't know about it, how does it fit with your idea of how a transparent state government should operate?
Well, I'm glad, you know, we have you and Austin doing jobs that are helpful to all of us. I'm just telling you, from what I've heard to date, I do not have concerns about this particular relationship of the state government with the federal government. That's the bottom line. Do I wish I knew everything that happened every single day? You bet. But I have not heard anything to date that has caused me concerns to believe anyone's civil rights have been violated or that we've had some abuse of our privacy in the state of Washington. I'm unaware of any such problem.
There's some talk about this program continuing, especially the undercover efforts for local officers to get these IDs. Would you support the continuation of this program with oversight from the legislature and the governor?
From what I know about it, yes. I think it is very important sometimes in these investigations that people be able to don different identifications. And frankly, we've seen, and it's very actually been surprising to me how many terrorist activities have been interdicted by efforts where we have had security agents donning a different identity. You know, we've had multiple prosecutions and convictions of people who did have clearly expressed intent and plans, action plans, to actually injure people in the United States. It surprised me how effective these have been, actually. So I would continue, from what I know of this program, I would continue it.
All right, last question on this. The specific CIA reference that the reporters found was expunged from the list when they got to look at it again. Why was that?
Well, to start with, I know this is going to sound terribly Cold War-ish or pedantic or even evasive, but I'm required to give you this answer, which is I just can't confirm to you what is or is not happening with the CIA or any other investigatory agency of the federal government. I just can't do that. So I can't accept the premise of your question, even for purposes of this discussion. It's an uncomfortable position, but it's a necessary one in the fulfillment of my responsibilities. So I'm doing it. And I can tell you that I've got a pretty finely honed antenna about abuses of privacy in our state. I've been very, very active when I was in Congress preventing abuses of our privacy by the banking industry. We actually passed a law that I was very active in that prevent banks from abusing people's privacy. I've been a protector of civil liberties and a whole host of issues. And from what I know about now, my finely tuned antenna has not gone into the yellow or red zone at all on this. I'm comfortable from what I know is happening.
You know, you have appointed new heads of the departments. You are now the head of this large and probably Byzantine bureaucracy. Given this secret, what are you doing? What are you saying to the heads of your various departments to help them root out other secrets that you might want to know?
Well, I'm trying to be very active. I'm trying to be right on the firing line. Yesterday, I was meeting with the Department of Commerce about their efforts. Actually, I met with about 100 members of the Department of Commerce on their ongoing efforts to woo businesses here, and we had a good discussion about that effort. I was at the employment. I just walked out. I do surprise visits. I just walk into these agencies and walk around and talk to the people who work. And I was at the Employment Security Department in Lacey. I just dropped in unannounced about 3 weeks ago, and I was actually very pleased what I found. I found a pleasant secret, which is that they are adopting the lean management that I've been pushing for. And I saw in action a plan where they're now evaluating the defects in the information flow that caseworkers get when they work on unemployment compensation claims for their clients. And I found a very impressive system of trying to improve the information flow so that we can make decisions much more efficiently with less failures much more quickly to reduce the waiting time for folks getting this service. And I was thrilled to see that in action in my walkthroughs. I did the same thing with the Department of Social and Health Services yesterday. I met some people who were working on a program to reduce recidivism of juvenile offenders. And I was pleased to learn they have a program now that's actually a leading effort in the nation to reduce recidivism by juvenile offenders. So I'm trying to be very active, and it's you learn a lot when you just drop in unannounced to these agencies and talk to line personnel. And I'm going to continue that through my governorship.
Governor, speaking of lean management, the Republicans in their budget pointed to lean management as offering them more than $159 million in potential savings. They used your ideas in their budget. Do you support what they have proposed? Do they go far enough? Do they go too far?
Well, I'm impressed that they want to continue with their lean management efforts. I think that's great. I don't think you can, on a prudent basis, pick a number out of the sky, though, as to what we will be able to do through a measurement of these programs. I think we should take the same approach that Boeing has taken to increase production of 737s by a factor of 2 at their Renton plant, that Virginia Mason Hospital views to become one of the number one ranked hospitals in the country, that Genie Industries that I visited in Moses Lake last week. And that is to adopt these systems, and this is a science of constant quality improvement to reduce the defects in your process and enhance the time that you can push the product through. And what Genie Industries was doing to reduce defects in Moses Lake that I saw, we need to be doing in every single state agency, and we're starting down that path. But if you talk to these executives at these businesses when they did this, they'll tell you that you can't put a number starting this process that has any degree of predictability on what number there is. So I don't think it's anything but a bit of a gimmick to ascribe a number to this right now. We've got to actually have a meaningful fiscal foundation for our schools, and that's why I've proposed putting $1.2 billion of real money, of real support, with real early childhood education and real STEM education and real improvements to improve graduation rates. That's what's going to help our kids, not, you know, sort of a phantom number that they've picked out of the air. And that's why I'm committed to closing some of these tax breaks that are not as important as our schools. I have chosen our schools over our tax breaks. I've chosen early education as opposed to, you know, or early help for a lobbyist who's pushing for a tax break. And I think that's the right approach for our state, and I'm pushing it. And I think we're going to make progress.
You know, on that note, here's an email from Mike. Please ask Mr. Inslee why he wants to cripple our state's craft brew beer industry that supports so much local business. He's talking about adding a tax on beer or keeping the tax on beer and spending it some of these local brewers. Is he right? Are you crippling the industry?
No, and it'd be the farthest from my desires. I love this industry. I love the people who are in it. They're great small business people. They're great entrepreneurs. The product is great. I've described it as the amber nectar of the gods, and that's how I think of it. We have proposed a multiple number of ways to generate dollars for schools, and one of them is to close the loophole that small brewers now enjoy. Right now, there is a tax of 4.7 cents, effectively. It translates to about a 4.7 cent per bottle of beer, and we tax the lower end scale of the beer, the cheaper beer, if you will. But those who make a product that's sort of what you might consider the higher end of the scale have this tax break where they do not pay that particular beer tax. So we propose closing that loophole and having all beer distributors and beer producers in the state of Washington pay the same amount, put that money into schools. And it's a hard thing to do, but it is 4.7 cents per bottle. And you know, we have to make some choices, and we've chosen early child education over that. And I'm hopeful this business is going to thrive and survive, and I believe it will.
Why do you believe it will? What have you heard about your tax break proposals, your continuation of some tax? What have you heard from the legislature that makes you feel that these guys are going to accept a good chunk of what I'm proposing?
Well, following my effort, I was the first here in the Capitol to propose closing these tax breaks, and I didn't do it just rhetorically. I did it in a real fashion. I identified them, a list of just under a dozen ones that I believe ought to be closed and have that money put into schools. Now, following that, the House has proposed a budget that has a different list, but about the same number, give or take. And what is or is not eventually on the list, that'll be a subject of a lot of discussion. Beer will have a lot of discussion, I'm sure. The House has proposed a version where you do what I have suggested, which is to treat all beer producers the same, but lower the rate. And that may be some approach that is workable. So we're going to have a lot of discussion to find the right and fair mixture. Mine was the first, but not the only proposal. And I'm open to all kinds of ideas. But here's the bottom line. We need to produce resources for our schools. It is hardly wise to not put a couple hundred million dollars in early childhood education. We know that's the single most effective thing we can do is to get the kids at age 3, 4, and 5 and prevent all the problems that happen if we don't make that investment. We have to have a way to finance that. We know we need to have ways to improve the graduation rate in this state. And we know when we have resources to do that, we can and do improve the graduation rates as much as 20% at Pasco and Renton and places. We know we have to produce more engineers in this state. Half of the people who work at Boeing will be retiring in the next decade. And if we're going to win the 737 replacement and the 777X, we need to make sure we have what we've always had, which is the highest skilled aerospace engineers and machinists and electricians in the world. And to do that, we have to have a focus on the production of people both at the machinist level and at the aeronautical engineering and civil engineering and electrical engineering degree programs, and that takes resources. So we've got to have that. I'm committed to doing that. I've proposed a way to do it, and I think we're going to get there.
Well, you know, your Republican colleagues say we can get there without these, quote, I'm quoting Mark Schossler here of Ritzville, without these job-killing taxes. They say they've done the same thing, brought more money without extending taxes or getting rid of these tax breaks. Are they wrong?
Well, I hate to say my Republican friends are wrong, but in this case, the math suggests that they are not wrong, but just dead wrong. And here's the reason why. You cannot produce over $1 billion of additional resources for our schools without revenues to do that with, unless you do several things. One, rely on phantom numbers and gimmicks. Two, you cut services for the seniors and disabled. Or three, you cut services for homeless kids. The Senate budget, the Republican budget, did all three of those things. They came up with phony numbers that were not identified, that just out of the blue, they picked a number and said, we're just going to cut. And that's just an across-the-board cut. We've been doing that for 3 or 4 years now, and that just doesn't cut the mustard because they haven't really identified what they would do. We're not going to start selling state parks. We've got to have a maintenance of effort of, you know, some basic government services. Two, they've reduced services for seniors and disabled. Now, we've been doing that for 3 or 4 years, and there's got to be a stop to that. I remember going down and spending a few hours with a woman just sort of job shadowing a care provider who cares for an elderly lady who lives down in Renton who is an amputee in a wheelchair, and she needed help even getting in and out of bed, and we'd already cut her by a day of services. They would continue to cut a variety of services that are available to senior citizens who are very, very vulnerable. They've also proposed cuts to programs that help, it's called Working Connections, that help children and families that want to get off of welfare and actually get back to work. We should not be reducing that assistance. We should be helping families get back to work. And I will not accept a budget that's going to make it more difficult for educators to educate these students. And here's the one thing I think we should all agree on. It's very difficult to educate a homeless, hungry, sick child. And the Republican budget cuts in significant ways to the tens of millions of dollars the services that would be available to these families and these kids. So we're going to be working to find the right mix to get this job done. But we have to understand everyone can have their own opinions, but no one is entitled to their own math. And the math on this is inescapable. We have to provide money for schools. And to do it, we're going to have to generate some revenues. And the best way to do that, in my book, is to close some of these tax breaks and continue a couple of the current tax levels that we're seeing a rebounding of our economy by having those and simply continue those and create $1.2 billion for kids That's my proposal.
All right, Governor, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today from Olympia. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Governor Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington State. By the way, if you did not hear Austin Jenkins' story on the Washington State Department of Licensing, you can go to our website, kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the retina doctors at Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, currently enrolling patients in a clinical trial testing an investigational drug to treat dry, age-related macular degeneration. Participation information is at vrawashington.com.
46 degrees in Seattle, anticipating a sunny day and highs in the upper 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at washingtonenergy.com.
It's 9:55. What sort of increased security is happening here in the wake of the bombings in Boston? King County Sheriff John Urquhart will answer that question in about 10 minutes.
Michael Fagan joins us now to give us a week's weather forecast and the hike. And Michael, I just want to say, in lieu of the tragedies that have been taking place in the mountains, you have been pretty diligent in steering folks away from the more dangerous areas because of avalanches and the likes, those like potential. So I just point that out, that as you've been giving us hikes throughout this winter season, you have been quite diligent about steering folks away from where there are potentials for avalanches and the like.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that is definitely our goal, is to have fun, but obviously be safe. And on the subject of safe, everyone heard the thunderstorms and saw the thunderstorms rolling yesterday. There is a slight chance of an afternoon thunderstorm, so we probably don't want to do the hike today. Again, the chance of the thunderstorm is slight, especially relative to what we had yesterday, but better be safe than sorry. So quick weather forecast, we're looking at highs in the mid to upper 50s in the city, slight chance of an afternoon shower. Wednesday's looking like a good day, so if you're going to go hiking, we don't have any thunderstorms in the forecast, and most of the day should be dry. And our hike will be Pinnacle Peak, right outside of Enumclaw. One of the highlights, this is a rather short hike. It's only 2 miles round trip, 1,000-foot gain. Now, we ran into a couple people. We did the hike yesterday, and a couple people thought the hike was too short, so we saw them run up and down about 3 times. So that is an option if you want to gain 3,000 feet.
There's diligence.
Yeah, that's very diligent. I think they were training for something. And again, the best day to do it is Wednesday. There'll be a chance of some showers Thursday and Friday, perhaps Saturday. And then Sunday might be a dry, sunny day. There's some nice views of the farmland outside of Enumclaw and into the foothills. Trillium flowers coming out. And for this trail, it's Green Trails Map 238 and it's King County Park, so you don't need a permit. And if you do go this during the weekend, this can be a busy trailhead, so you should get out early. Now, if this 2 mile round trip is too short and you want to do another hike instead of going up and down 3 times on the same peak, we have Clay Creek, which is about 15-minute drive right down Highway 410. And if you do this Wednesday, you'll get some nice views of Mount Rainier, White River, and this hike is 2.5 miles one way, 1,000-foot gain. So if you do the hike, both these hikes will be a good workout. And for this last hike, Clay Creek, it's Green Trails Map 237, and you need a Hancock permit for that. And we have both these hikes on the blog. So plenty of safe hikes, and we are avoiding the snow with the avalanche issues, that's for sure.
All right, Michael, I appreciate that. Thank you for talking to us. HikeWashington.net is the website you should check. We have a link, HikeWashington.net. We'll show you the hikes Michael Fagan is talking about. He's with West Coast Weather, LLC.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of a licking and grunting mother ewe named Lizzie as she cleans and reassures her newly born lamb. When weekday listener Vincent recorded this sound, the lamb was only minutes old. There you go. Spring is coming to the farm in Bayview on Whidbey Island, and Vincent says this time of year is especially exciting for his daughter, Maggie Rose, who loves to help out with anything involving critters. Thanks for the sound. Weekday continues. Stay with us.
46 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for sun today and a high of 58.
Support for KUOW comes from Fuller Theological Seminary Northwest, offering master's degrees in theology and divinity at its Seattle campus, multi-denominational with on-site and online class schedules to fit busy lives. Next information session is on May 4th. Information at fuller.edu/northwest.
The train tracks that run along Puget Sound have seen more.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.